I want to tell you about something I've used and I truly believe in. Replayer. It's a sideline camera built for youth sports. Just set it up, hit record, and it captures the entire game automatically. No chasing the ball, no holding your phone, just hands-free, stress-free recording. The in-game tagging is one of my favorite features. One tap, and you can mark a big goal, ankle-breaking moves, or a clutch tackle. Then pull those clips for later for review, highlights, or social media. And the live streaming's next level. A buddy of mine actually watched his son's game while flying cross country at 30,000 feet. That blew me away. If you're a parent or coach at the field every weekend, Replayer is a game changer. Head to replayer.com. That's Replayer.com. And I think you'll be amazed. Hey, soccer friends. I just want to give a shout out to our partner, TeamPlayer. They are changing the game on how you find the perfect soccer team for your player. Parents, this means no more endless social media scrolling to find information on teams. With TeamPlayer, everything you need to know is just a few clicks away. It's simple, straightforward, and lets you find the best coach and team for your player without any of the usual headaches. And coaches, we all know how tough it can be to get your team noticed, but when you subscribe to one of Team Player's team plans, you instantly get access to set up an online team profile that allows you to reach more potential players and showcase what your team is all about. It's super easy and lets players and parents see why your team could be the right fit for them. And if you sign up using the promo code PITCH, you can try any team plan free for 1 month. So whether you're managing a team or searching for one, come on over to www.teamplayer.us. That is TeamPlayer.us. And come give Team Player a look. Family-owned Soccer Innovation is your go-to source for top-quality equipment. Whether you're a player, a supportive family member, or a dedicated coach, they have everything you need to elevate your game. For players, their innovative equipment are designed to boost your skills and performance on the pitch. From their agility cones to their portable goals, they have you covered. And family members, they offer durable equipment that's built to last because we know your support is critical to your player. Coaches, trust me, they can provide the equipment you need to run effective training sessions and shape the next generation of soccer players. Visit Soccer Innovations at soccerinnovations.com to start elevating your game with them. And if you use the code PITCH, PITCH, you can receive up to 10% off your next order. Hello and welcome back to Chat by the Pitch. This is Ian Babcock, your host. This week, I have ODP. I have Warren on to talk about what ODP is. I'm not going to let him explain it because he does a way better job than anything I can get into. And let's start this chat and head to the pitch.
My name is Warren Cottle. I'm the Director of Coaching and Player Development with the North Texas Soccer Association, dealing primarily with coaching education and the Olympic Development Program. So it's been the end of a first year of the program, and it's been a lot of fun. I learned a lot and I'm looking forward to trying to build it and make it better.
Awesome. I know that ODP stands for Olympic Development Program. How long has it been around and what is the function of this program?
Well, it started back in 1977 and it was through the United States Youth Soccer Program in a way for identifying talent for the national teams back in the time. So it's grown from then over the course of the years to now, where it's one of the pathways into that program.
It's one of the pathways into the programs for the men's, the national team for men's and women's side, or is it more looking trying to pass them into the youth program?
Most of it's hollow. Obviously, there's different parts of the national team. If you're looking at full U.S. soccer all the way down, I think they're identifying this year's the 2010s to all the way to the 2017s. We actually go to next year will be the 2014s. This year, the first year is 2013s. And so it's a way to get identified through U.S. youth soccer, rather, to go into to not only competing, getting to work with other players within their age groups, and then competing around at different events that are held in different states. I know we're part of the South region, So primarily we play with teams from the Atlantic seaboard all the way to Texas and from Kentucky south. So Tennessee, so anywhere Florida, Georgia, you know, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and all the states in between that make up the south region of ODP.
With the regions, are you in the south? Or is it southwest or is it just straight south?
Straight south.
Okay.
So I guess we're southern boys here, southern boys and girls.
Now, that being said, do you play from the Atlantic coast to how far west again? Sorry.
We're the edge of the south region. So from New Mexico on, then starts the west region.
Perfect.
And so that goes to California. It's broken into four different regions.
So do you only play majority in the south? Then is it a regional, then it goes to a national level or two regions, then they compete and then move on to another region? Or is it regional, then national?
For us, it's changing. So we do most of our, had in the past, have done our competition within the south region. So we have an event that's rotated throughout the different states. In the spring, we call it our June championships. That's going to change a little bit here, hopefully in the next year. Then we'll usually have a smaller function that we usually include South Texas. Next year, it's going to be in Oklahoma. It'll include Louisiana, Arkansas, us, and South Texas as well. But then we're also adding an event where we're going to go to the West Championships and take our teams in April, for our non-high school teams, because it's happening during high school season in January. We'll go to Arizona, play teams from Hawaii, California, Alaska, and so forth.
That's
awesome. And that'll be for younger teams. For older teams, we usually typically looking for college showcases for their preparations going into the June championships. So we usually do two showcases, and it's been historically been Scott Diamond in Dallas, as well as Sports Source. But we're looking at adding one and adjusting a few things just because a lot of times we have player conflicts. We've got players that play in different leagues and different clubs. And so it's hard to do, for example, for the girls, when a majority of our players play club, but they're also playing in that event, to be able to get those players to play on two different teams. And sometimes not fair to the player either, because it takes a lot of energy from them to be able to perform at the level they need to play at, to be able to showcase themselves in front of those college coaches.
So that brings a question I was going to wait for later for, but you, from the sounds of it, you go to college showcases to show off the talent that you have with ODP. These players, do majority of them already play club then, and this is their chance to have another showcase, or is it more along the lines of they may not play at a high enough, their team may not play at a high enough level to have a showcase chance?
Well, that might be a couple of factors. There's ones that you can be at any showcase you want, but I think historically the Olympic development format has been a conglomeration of the best players within the state that group together. Now, obviously, with the addition like an ECNL or MLS Next, some now the players are going to that round. So now we're primarily dealing with the players that may not be seen. And so we're able to take them to these showcases to get them identified, hopefully to play college ball, and then trying to find the diamonds in the rough that are out there that may not be able to afford the high price of club or play on one of the higher clubs that's in an ECL or in the MLS Next. We do have a kind of to stand out that we're trying a new program in West Texas where we're actually going to use in conjunction with the universities. Right now we've got West Texas A&M, Lubbock Christian, University of Texas Permian Basin, Angelo State University, Abilene Christian, Arne Simmons, and Howard Payne have all joined in. I believe we're going to get McMurray on as well, but trying to find a way to rebuild our West Texas program, because that's where I actually started in my ODP career that eventually led to this job. But to have it to where we can take players, train for the Olympic development teams, we only train four times in the fall and four in the spring, but take them to a college where they can be seen, work with college coaches, and help them grow with that pathway too. And if that works out well, we're going to try to do that throughout the rest of the state and try to make it not only for identification to like a national team or that kind of program, but really try to find ways to bridge the gap that some of these kids have between their desire to play college soccer as well as performing at the next level.
You brought up the MLS Next, or the MLS side of this equation, and ECNL. As a parent, the one thing I hear about ODP, and this is hearsay and not, I don't know how much of it's true or accurate, but ODP might be, they say ODP is struggling because you aren't able to grab the top talent in the communities because Club A or Club B might not want their players playing for ODP. And this is something that I hear from quite a few parents, that how can you say you have the best talent when the best talent are not being released from their clubs to participate in ODP?
It may not be the best talent at that time, because working with the Federation, they go to the ECNL games, they have scouts that they hire out to do ECNL and MLS next to identify players. And so to their point, your parents are correct, that they've actually got a different pathway. And so that's where it makes, I think, ODP kind of a special process or a prospect, because there's a lot of clubs out there that aren't involved in those things. There's clubs that are playing at different levels, but there's still a lot of talent out there that's available that may be overlooked or may not be seen based upon maybe location, based on cost of a program. As well as I do, I truly believe most of our clubs are really good people that are really caring, but there's a few out there that'll hold on to an athlete that could be a higher level player they're not willing to release, because if they release that player, then that drops the level of the club team and therefore they may lose players. But what ODP does is it offers that player in a non-competitive manner, as far as competing between a club and our deal. Because at the end of the day, that allows that player to get identified where they may not. Because our big thing is we're not here to compete with clubs. We're not here to go in and try to take anybody away from any program or anything else. Our mission in our program is to help identify players regardless of where they at and meet them at their needs, regardless of where they play, who they play for. We're just trying to help people. And that's what our program does, if that makes sense.
It does. I think families tend to and look at it as and I feel like a lot of things out there for youth sports, doesn't matter, soccer, it's all youth sports. There's a lot of money grabbing opportunities. That's what, as they describe them. And I feel like, yes, I feel like we have a pay to play model, and it's very different than the rest of the world when it comes to this type of stuff. So it is a opportunity, from the sounds of it, to have players that might not have a chance to be seen. With that being said, how do you encourage clubs to release players then? Because I feel at the end of the day, to have the top competition to come in is so critical, because at the end of the day, what is it? Iron sharpens iron.
Oh, no, for sure.
And we want the best coming out of Texas.
Well, I'll go back on my point of most of your club coaches. We do have quite a few on the girls' side, for example. We have a lot of ECNL players that play within our program. Most of the coaches will say it's okay to do both, and they actually share players. Of course, there's a couple out there that don't see it that way, and there's not really a way that I can change it. I'm not going to go to a club coach and say this is the only way or only path. They're in the same intention for their players to give them the best opportunity to go to another level, to be at a higher level. May be that through our program, they can be seen in a different manner to use some of the opportunities that we provide, as well as what they do. To be a good coach, you got to have a little bit of ego. Sometimes I think the ego gets out of hand, whether it be from our side or their side. Sometimes they hold on to it because they're the only show in town. That's unfortunate. In the end of the day, it limits players, limits them in their development, but it's the nature of the beast and nature of the business.
I find it fascinating that the ODP program, when I did my little bit of homework on this topic, because I try, as I tell everyone, I try not to do too much research, because I want to be hitting this information fresh and not having an already built-in opinion. When you're going through this process of finding players, how hard is it for them to find you then? Because at the end of the day, if you're trying to build a program, and I'm doing a, say, take the club players out of the equation, let's say you have rec organizations that have some great ballers. You hear stories, my favorite stories from the Metroplex is someone found Ricardo Pepe playing at a high school, and they found him.
Man.
And to hear that story, they saw him playing at a high school, and they went and found his family and recruited him to come to FC Dallas, to play for FC Dallas's academy, made the first team, and now is playing over in Europe, is one of the best stories I've heard. It's not many stories like that in the community, but with the club side, I don't know what his family's financial situation was, but to be good enough to make the talent, to make the high school team and go play, how do you figure out how to find talent? Do you go watch rec or have opportunities or put the word out there for families to find you all so these players may have an opportunity to be seen that might not be seen through a club?
I'm hoping that one way is through this podcast, maybe through your listeners, through your viewers, it may be one way of doing it. I do know that we've reached out to high schools and we're trying to include them in because I'm an old high school coach myself. We had a young man named Leo at Grapevine High School as our rival when I was at Colleyville Heritage. But that kid was unbelievable, phenomenal. I couldn't figure out a way to stop him. Great kid. And he went on to Sheffield Wednesday for a while. And I think he's now back with the program here at FC Dallas, the second team, North Texas SC. And so there's all kinds of those kids out there that aren't being seen. And that's where I think our niche right now is to find those. A lot to me, if we had a player like a Pepe or like a Leo, that through this Olympic development program that an FC Dallas were able to identify and see as a result of the participation, and then moves them on in. Because I think the success of our program would be that we find those players that these clubs could use to push on within the higher programs as well, that someday we're talking about a Pepe, how it was found in the Olympic development program, or much a Leo that was at Grapevine High School that are out there. But there's a lot of those kids that are overlooked for different reasons. And to your point, we've got a lot of phenomenal recreational programs out there. Just think about the size of our market alone. Or you look at places like Arlington or South Dallas or South Fort Worth that may not have the resources to be able to play at a high level, but you go watch a high school game, for example. What's that school? South Hills High School in South Fort Worth, that unbelievable amounts of talent, but doesn't have the financial resources to be able to play. And so that's one of the initiatives we're trying to find to get those players in, to give them the opportunities so that maybe we have more Pepes in the future.
And so with this, let's move into the cost structure a little bit. As a parent, I heard it's something like $600 to come try out, but that if you make ODP, that includes your kit that you need to have for ODP. Now, is that a true number, or is that just a number that I overheard and people are not being fully honest or overhearing something else?
Yeah, 100%. So to break down the fees, I think it's $125 to try out. And what that does is pays for our coaches that run the sessions. It also pays for the fields, logistics, and whatnot. And so that's the cost there. The kit usually is around, try to keep it lowest, about less than $100. Each round, and that's for the practice uniform, the shorts, the practice top, and the jerseys in two colors. And then I think it's, I have to look at the budget again, but it's around $200 or $300, $390, I think, is what we charge for the year to participate within the program. And that pays for practices, that pays for the coaches, and that pays for the fields, which are an incredible expense. So all told, the total cost for the whole program for 8 practices over the year is less than $600. With that, if somebody's struggling, we've got in place within the budget $7,390 worth of scholarship funds. I'm just looking at the numbers here. And within that too, there's applications, a way to apply for scholarships to help the funding to get it in. If you look at the average individual skill session or private lessons that people are willing to pay, it's anywhere from $30 to $150 an hour for a private lesson. Whereas our ODP program, if you figure that over the amount of hours that we spend in training with tryouts, it ends up being anywhere less than $25 an hour.
Right.
To participate within the ODP program. As far as cost, it's pretty cheap for what you're getting.
So with that being said, do you actually have outside sponsors that come in and try to help offset costs for you all? Or is it you are not allowed to because of the type of organization you are?
At this point in time, it's something I want to look at, and then I'm going to plead ignorance on this just because it's the first year within the program. But I've always envisioned a type of thing where we could have something like, say, for example, Hispanic Chamber of Commerce that came in and helped funds to get us into certain markets to help us find and identify players. Because at the end of the day, North Texas is not here to make a ton of money on a program, right? I'm not going to get paid more or less based upon how many people we have in ODP. It's more of a service that we provide to the members of North Texas, to the membership, and helping identify players. My view is if I could find sponsors, and I'll look into that for sure, but it'd be neat if we got this down to zero cost and we're able to get into those markets to be able to help people. The one thing I have found, being in the soccer world as long as I have, for some reason, people equate quality with cost, which blows my mind. So apparently, And I hope this doesn't offend my club friends, because I have unbelievable great coaches and people I deal with. But the more I charge, for some reason, the more people think the value is. And so I thought maybe we could OEP at 10 grand and we'd be the greatest thing on earth. But jokes aside, I don't think that's really the route that we want to take. We want to keep it cheap to where people can afford it, to where we can actually provide a service that helps other people.
With that being said, I always, my wife and I have long conversations about the pay-to-play model here in the United States. And I don't think parents truly understand the difference between here and the rest of the world. And this is something that I'm trying to work on with connections that I have made, is getting people to understand the rest of the world's soccer model. Like you said, the more expensive something is, people think it's a higher quality. I interviewed Nolan Norris last year, and his All-In Academy, when him and I talked, it was $10 a session. And here you have a professional soccer player running like a youth academy and only charging $10.
Right.
That just showed me his character, who he was as a person. I know my son has had private lessons, and they can range anywhere. The most expensive one I've ever heard so far is $225 for 1 hour.
Oof, your range is way bigger than mine.
And I about died when I heard 225. My son has a private coach that I absolutely adore, and we just haven't had time to use him. But I really loved his philosophy. It's, we have our hour, but he makes wiggle room, so there's time to go over if they aren't getting to what they need to get. And I think that's so important for families. And it sounds like you're doing the same type of idea with ODP here, trying to create that wiggle room for families to have a chance. And like you said, people don't value something if it doesn't cost a fortune. And I think I have a different view. I think because I've been doing this, I'm a little bit more jaded now when it comes to all this, when it comes to cost. So when you do travel to your tournaments and your showcases, now, how is that cost broken down? Is it something that you have within your budget that reduces the cost for players? Or like you said, you have almost $8,000 for scholarships, if I'm remembering the number right, or $7,500
right.
for scholarships. Does that help cover the cost for that? Or is that something on the outside of all this?
What happens is, so looking at the budget right now, so we go to that Arizona championship in January, for the younger age groups, what we'll do is we'll charge $225. And what that does is cover the cost of the coaches and registration fee and then transportation and whatnot. But that's the only cost that we have outside of what it's going to cost for the family to travel. We're not going to charge more than that, but that's what it costs the family. Now, there's obviously going to be cost incurred to the family, which is the cost to get out there, the cost to get a hotel room, obviously food and whatnot. But that's the cost that's incurred by the family to go to these events, if that makes sense. And so what we do is that if they're eligible for the scholarship, then we'll waive the portion of that $225, or depending on how many people apply, the whole $225, and try to supplement the cost there on our side, the stuff that we can do. I know, for example, for the region ODP event that's coming up in North Carolina next week, we had a couple of people reach out and we were able to defer the cost of the a couple or three of them that applied.
So when you say defer the cost for the player to go and travel, does the parents come with them, or is it just the cost to go play?
Just the cost to play. So the $225 is what our scholarship covers. So out that, we don't really, within $8,000, you can imagine, gets eaten up pretty quickly over, what is it? I think we had 500 participants in the program this year. You know, so obviously we can't afford to, with our low cost that we charge, to be able to send a family to be able to pay travel costs on that end. But there's ways that they can do it, whether they travel with a teammate or find a way to get to the event with the family, then there's ways to incorporate or help with costs that way. But otherwise, we mostly just help with the costs that we charge.
So they're on the, and I think this is where me as a parent, these numbers get skewed, because what I might go spend to go travel is completely different but another family.
The truth.
I look at this as a family, as when I've talked to a sports psychologist here, and the advice they told me, soccer will never be what we want it to be until it's played in the poorest communities, like it is played basketball or baseball or American football, that it will never be successful until it hits those communities and is attainable by them. Because if you look at American football, most of these teams that play here, they're getting money from the outside. They have corporate sponsorships that are on the youth level. They are, even with basketball, or especially baseball. Baseball is very expensive. I'm not even going to talk about hockey.
Right.
And going through this, if we want soccer to be like American football, baseball, or basketball, we have to find a way to make it attainable to all. And that's why I ask about the scholarships and the financial side, because at the end of the day, to go to a tournament for 5 days for a family, that's about $1,000, not including airfare yet, and airfare is not getting any cheaper. It's very hard for families that may not have the means. So that's why I ask about the scholarship side.
No, it's true. There's a lot of truth to that. And just I was thinking about your hockey thing. There's not much ice in Texas, is there?
No.
But it's definitely expensive, but you're 100% correct. And we could probably do a whole podcast, which I'm sure you have, on that one subject. Because then how do you relate to different costs? And I always wondered if then the time when, you know, basketball, football, and track are all free at the school or school, whatever, the interscholastic level. And so I'm wondering if that's where we get that big drop off for the one reason you're talking about.
It is. For sports, for families, you lose them at the club level and they only play at the high schools because most kids that have their families don't have the means to play. And I know we're getting off tangent a little bit, but they drop off after rec, or if they no longer getting a scholarship from a club or whatever the case may be. And it's interesting hearing that. I was talking to a parent and they spent $20,000 for their one child to go play in ECNL. And I'm like, I don't think I could afford that. You're now just making the gap even bigger from mediocrity to players that can afford it. And I'm not saying these kids that have the financial well-being behind them aren't talented, but you're pushing that gap bigger. And that's, as a parent, it breaks my heart because I'm not coached. We had a kid and we only charged $25 a month for coaching fees. And this is at a club. Like, we worked it out with the club, and because it's 5 and 6 years old, so there's not much they can have.
Right.
We literally charged $25 a month, and knowing that was a struggle for a few families broke my heart. But we as coaches did not, we fundraised and we literally had no extra costs. Like, parents didn't have to pay more than that $25. And that's unheard of at a club level. That paid for our tournaments, our leagues, and everything. And I think as a society, we have to change that. And it sounds like with ODP, you're doing the best with the means that you have to provide that.
Our purpose is to find those that maybe not afford, maybe those that can, but just to try to find an additional pathway to advance their soccer skills, be it through the national team programs, be it collegiate, be it through just participation through in our events, but to give an environment that they're going to learn and grow and participate with like-minded players. I'm super interested in trying to figure out ways in the future to minimize those costs for players and keep them included. There's a lot of interest, especially being an old high school coach. There's a lot of talented players out there that no longer have the means to play. They can't really afford the non-school participation programs that are really good players. Lost to the deal. And I wonder, too, just in looking around, because growing up in West Texas, especially within the immigrant families that come in from all over Latin America, they had the ethnic leagues out there that were unbelievably talented. Those kids could play. And they're great salt of the earth kind of kids that are going to work their tails off. I got the pleasure of coaching them when I was in Midland, when they came to Midland High.
That was a conversation my wife and I have. And a while back, it was talking about how in different parts of this country, like the people that do immigrate here, and where soccer is just part of their culture. It is, they watch it as a family. They play it as a family. They go to events as a family that are all soccer related. And most people in the United States, my family, we watch more soccer now than we did in the past, but we're not. I am more so. And my son is more so, are very ingrained in soccer, but a lot of families are not that way. They don't go watch soccer matches. They don't watch them on TV. It's just something they do or their kid does, and that's the end of it. And it's changing the culture, and how do you make it more soccer-oriented? Because at the end of the day, if you want better soccer players, they need to be eat, living, and breathing the sport.
Go ahead. To go on a little further tangent, let's go a little further than that. I wonder how much our society leads that way, too, because when you and I were growing up, we had the old thing where you don't come in until the light's on outside. But how many kids are outside just playing the game? So to your point, if you look at different countries, say for Spain, for example, mom lives over there, you walk in any public square and the kids are out playing.
Yes.
Constantly. So they watch the TV, but they're more, you're not going to a private coach to do soccer lessons. You're going out with your buddies and trying to emulate what you saw on TV with your friends.
I will say every private coach that I've ever had my son sent to have all said, you need to go play more pickup games with your friends. You need to be in the park playing, using these skills that we're working on here, there to master them.
Yes.
We get them down here, technically speaking, but if you don't go use them in a match. And one of my favorite people I've been listening to lately, I don't know if you follow him on Instagram, but it's Kyle Wilson Official.
Okay.
He's called the Angry Soccer Coach. And he talks about, what's the point of doing a skill in practice if you're not going to go turn around within 10 minutes of actually applying that skill set in a one-on-one circumstance? So if you're going to go work on scissors, it's great that you do them in the backyard. But if you're not doing them one-on-one against someone, what's the point within 10 minutes? Because the muscle memory may be there, but the actual side of using that skill is gone. I love watching these kids play soccer and they do 15 scissors standing in one spot.
They're still standing in front of a defender.
Right.
Yeah.
Are they still standing in front of a defender doing 15 scissors and the defender just kicks the ball and runs away? And that is the thing that you're right. You have to go out and play. That's something that drives me absolutely crazy here in North Texas. And you have all these beautiful fields, but they're rented out by someone. And they may be public fields, but you can't use them. And this goes back to the society issue of respectful of property, because the properties will be destroyed. I hate going to a public park and you see all the soccer goals locked up. Or I live near Keller and Keller Soccer Association has beautiful fields, but they aren't open to public. But it's a public organization. And I get they have to protect the property, but at the same time, you can't encourage the game when you go to the park down the street and there's more potholes in it and you're going to roll your ankle. I'm all for playing on crappy fields because it makes you better when you play on a nice field, and that's a whole other topic. But those are issues that I see as a parent. Or I've asked if we could go use my son's, where he trains, if we can go there during the day, just to have an open space that's bigger than our backyard.
Kind of your point.
Answer. Go ahead.
Yeah, went back when I was at Collegeville Heritage. We had unbelievable equipment. We had the little pug goals, the fold-out goals, full-size goals, and it used to break my heart because I thought, okay, I'm just going to leave these things out. I did that until one of them got stolen. And then I quit leaving little goals out. Then I did the bigger goals, the corner goals, until the feet were stolen. And then a pole was stolen, so then couldn't leave that out. Then I did that with the big goals until people would play the game and they'd leave, they'd take that goal, they'd move right in the middle of the field and just leave it there. Or they'd rip your nets up or cut them all up. The original idea was to leave the equipment out, but then somebody comes up and destroys the equipment. It's crud. So poor Keller Soccer Association, you only afford so many nets, only so many goals before after a while you go, how could I leave them out? And that's the real tragedy.
That's the thing, but it makes people think. This is why I like having blocking 2 hours, is because we can go off tangents. We can talk about other things.
Oh, no.
I struggle as a parent taking my kids to a tryout. And I want to hear about your tryout method and what you do, because what is your tryouts like for ODP?
So we're looking at that, and luckily we're adding some pieces into it. So we usually block 2 2-hour sessions per age group. So, for example, we're going to go to McKinney at Fairview Park on the 28th of July, which will be our first tryout. We've tried to get away because in the first year here, we inherited some time slots that weren't ideal. And so we're going to go early in the morning for one gender, late in the afternoon for a different gender. It's on our website for anybody interested. And then we'll come back and go to Eagle Mountain Saginaw ISD, which shout out to those people, because they've been unbelievably supportive and helpful of the program, and especially helping the people around in their community to get involved in soccer. But then we go to their site and we'll host tryouts there. So within that 2 hours, we're going to get as many coaches on the site as possible. The goal is to get anywhere between 10 to 15 players for one coach and have them go around. We're also going to use our new VOs that we just got in the spring to not only take the time that they're on the field, but the evaluations will be done post-practice with the VOs to either look and see if we made mistakes or lost some players, or to confirm some of the evaluations that the coaches have already seen. And head coaches look back at the information they've got to make the most informed decision as possible based on those two. I know that one of the things that we talked about beforehand was about having it over a week, as well as I do. The biggest problem with that is cost. It is unbelievably expensive to rent fields. Then you add on the cost that you have to pay the coaches because they're unbelievable people. And we've got a great coaching staff. The problem is that if you've got a great coaching staff, they're not going to work for free and they shouldn't have to. At the end of the day, they need to be compensated for their time away from their families because they're giving themselves to the program and to our kids. So that's one of the limiting factors. So hopefully between the number of coaches that we're going to have evaluating in addition to the VOs, we can make as an informed decision as we possibly can based upon these athletes.
You only have so much funds and so much time. And as a parent, I'm always glad to send my kid to a camp, especially a soccer camp. My son has played in several soccer camps over the last 5 years, and he has, this year is the first year he's not going to five different soccer camps, just because we're home and we're not using it as a babysitting service.
Right.
But I have no problem spending, I'll be honest, $250, $300 for a week for him to go play soccer for 6.5 hours, hours as a camp. Would you ever look at it from that perspective as saying, if we start an ODP camp as part of a selection process to get kids in, so you see more kids and offer lessons, and you also, when they come and try out, they're already have been recognized or seen before they come? Because at the end of the day, it's another angle to get more kids in. Is it something that you could find space for and able to do? Because that way no one's working for free.
No, for sure.
They deserve to be paid for their time. But at the same time, this gives you a chance to properly evaluate. Because as a parent, this is where I am at. If a coach tells me they want my kid after the first practice, it's not a coach for me. And because for me, my son, I know my son, he needs 2 to 3 practices to settle in with the teammates. And probably 1 or 2 practices more to understand the coach. And I'm not saying every kid needs 5 training sessions, 6 training sessions to be with a coach. My son tried out for a team this year. He knew several of the players. It's unbelievable watching them. Just how much they have, the chemistry was still there that they had from when they were younger.
Oh, for sure.
The coach noticed that and talked about it with us. But at the same time, I'm not going to go up to the coach and ask the first session, do you want him? I just want to know, was he polite and did he do okay? That's all I care about. Was he polite and was he okay for you? And I'll reach out and ask. If they offered us to come out again, I'll make the arrangements to come out again. But if they don't say anything, I'm not going to waste my time. Because all I care about is, was he polite and doing what he needed to do for you? Because I know my son. I know what type of player he is. He needs to settle in. And the advice I was given, never take a coach's first offer or right within the first 24 hours because they don't have a good feel for your player. Because it could just be, they could just have a fluke of a practice and had a bad one. Or they could have a fluke of a great practice and you don't see the full player. And I'm looking at both sides. Is it something that you guys might do in the future?
Actually, to be honest with you, I never considered the camp thing before. Would it be in the first year? That may be something I look into because that your point, it makes a ton of sense, and I'll call it the in camp. But what we'll do is we'll go in, and that may be something for next year. Obviously, within this cycle, it's too late to put something like that together, but it's an intriguing idea. And I agree to your point with we're going to make mistakes, and I'll be upfront. We're going to miss some players within our 2 days, and it's happened in the past. It's going to happen, to your point. Maybe that was the days or 2 days that they were lights out, but then they turn into straight donkeys after, or vice versa. They come out and they don't play as well over those couple of days, you know, being sick or nervous or whatever. And so there's those players that we miss along the way. One of the things I'm looking at doing is sending our coaches out to the various leagues at times to try to see if there's not somebody out there that we can pick up that maybe we did miss an ODP. That if our goal is to identify the best players possible, then sometimes we're going to have to get our comfort zone and go find them. But that's an interesting idea. I really like your camp idea.
Now, with that being said, as the program grows, I know colleges have scouts just
Right.
Former players that want to help out their alma maters, and they'll go, the coach will ask them to go watch a player, and they aren't doing it because they're making a buck. They're doing it because they care about their... Are you looking at expanding to do something like that, where you have people that are part of the community that are at fields and games that can give recommendations, or parents that are trustworthy, so to speak, to give recommendations? Hey, have you looked at this player or that player on this team? Because at the end of the day, I'm a parent. I'm always evaluating who my son's playing against. What's their weakness? How's my son's weaknesses right. and strengths going to help overcome and beat this player? One thing my son and I worked on at a very young age, we need to get back into it again, is identifying what foot within warmups the other teams are warming up in. That means he has to pay attention to what he's doing in his warmups. But when he starts playing, to identify immediately if they're right footed or left footed, which way to push them, which way to force them to go. Are they a skillful person? Can they? And that's something him and I used to do as for fun. I would challenge right. them before the game to look at that stuff. And having parents willing to take that initiative for you at matches that they're watching, because there's like 300,000 kids every weekend in the Metroplex going out to play soccer. And
right.
that's 300,000 families roughly going out and watching kids play. And if you have 1% of that, means you have 300 families trying to help you find talent.
Well, I think that's probably not a bad idea at all. The only thing that I'd be concerned with, and just to be totally transparent, is that you'll get a lot of the parents that recommend their own kid. But I could totally see if somebody comes in and says, hey, at X team and X location, this kid was unbelievable and stood out. Now, obviously, to the level they're playing at may be an adjustment factor, to where, let's say, XYZ recreational program, they've got the kid that scored 5 goals because he's the biggest, fastest, strongest, and we're just banging balls to him, and he outruns everybody.
Right.
But never makes soccer decisions. That's going to be a little different than if you take, say, an ECL team where now that kid's torching everybody, but making soccer decisions, because that's another complaint that we'll get into maybe some other podcast, but sometimes we're not teaching them how to think the game or recognize or learn the game or understand the game in such a way that it's not about just power and speed, but it's about decision-making processes within the game. But I would love to have somebody reach out and say, hey, look, there was this kid, XYZ recreational program, that was fantastic.
And that, I was always told, if you have someone that has a great soccer IQ, you can teach them to do anything.
Not for sure.
Going along the same line, so as you're building up this time and building up these players, you meet, you said, 4 times a year or 8 times a year?
Eight times a year.
Do you meet more 100%. Often than that, or is it you're just hoping that they connect in those 8 sessions? Because I look at the national team, and I feel like our national team, a lot of the disconnect comes from because they don't get to play together, and the chemistry is not there, and it's very hard, even at young ages, to build chemistry. I will say, every successful team I've ever watched, if they don't have chemistry in the beginning of the season, and by the end of the year, they actually have chemistry, they're a force to be reckoning with. Doesn't matter the skill level, because they know how to read each other and play with each other. How do you create that chemistry if you're only meeting 8 times a year then?
So the magic of it, and one of the things that I think we do an exceptional job of, is, and especially, not to toot my own horn, but I remember my 2005 girls that I had, and that was the team that led me into this job. First of all, is relationships, building relationships between each other, getting to know each other, getting to know people. And it's really magic when you see these girls come together that play against each other, and they find out, oh, this person I'm now working with in ODP is actually the girl I hated when I was playing against, but turns out she's a pretty neat kid. And so I think a lot of that has to do with that. When you think about training these kids, you're going to be more focused on tactical aspects of the game, much like a national team would be, to get them to understand how to play together, how to work together. So when they do these different events, that they're prepared to play within a system that's going to be efficient, using, to your point, the high soccer IQ, to be able to put a team together and make them compete together. Now, obviously, if you only have 4 practices of ball 4 in the spring, there's going to be some things you're going to miss, and it's not going to be as fine-tuned as it would be if you're competing or playing and training together twice a week. But the limiting factor on the number of practices, I think mostly, is to don't want to overdo it. Because if we train once a week for the fall and once a week in the spring, we could obviously adjust the cost. We can make it work on our end. But my gosh, that's just like one more thing to do. It's already a burden on families and friends. And we're going to try to keep a space that has our own little niche. I think part of the niche is just getting kids together, try to identify kids for different levels. But you can also overdo that because, no offense to most people, but there's a lot of people that would do that. They would play two games on a Saturday, come out to ODP on a Sunday, and do that every week until we grind the kid in the ground. And so that's not really something that I think is appropriate or something that we want to do. And that's why we try to keep the cost low, have trainings that are effective, they usually 2 hours in length, and then get them back in and get them together and try to identify them for different programs.
I forgot to say, Coach Joe's idea was the camp.
Oh, yeah. So Coach Joe, thank you very much.
Right? You're Johanna, yes.
Yeah, no, she's an amazing person.
I just released her episode this past week. For time frame for anyone that's listening, so you know when this is being interviewed.
Yes, Coach Joe. And she probably told me that too, but that's actually a really good idea.
As a parent, and as I'm thinking through this, as you're talking about chemistry, like I said, I am more than happy to send my son to a positive environment to get positive touches on the ball in a camp. So if you had like a camp for the ODP players that are able to make it, would you be open to doing something like that? So let's say spring break or fall break or winter break, you have extra time. My son loves to play the game. He'll go play with a bunch of five-year-olds if that's all he has to play with. Will he get frustrated at times? Yes. But will he want to go play? Yes. And for ODP to offer a ODP camp, so to speak, yes, it's an extra cost, an extra burden on the family or the community. Some parents might actually do it. And if it's their coaches that are going to be working with them, I think the chemistry has a chance to be built there too. Just an idea, throwing it out there, building on those ideas of a before tryouts start, having an ODP camp. Or skills, or whatever it may be, because at the end of the day, if you charge them $25 a player to come out for a 2-hour session on a Saturday morning, every other weekend or a month before tryouts, I think you're going to get a lot of kids, especially through the months of May, June, and July, and I don't know when your tryouts are. We haven't got that far yet. But if you had camps where they only get charged $25 for 2 hours of session, you get more kids coming out, and you might be able to see more talent that you might not see. Yeah.
No, I think it's a great idea. Yeah, because that's a lot of what we look at. A lot of it is developing teams within small-sided games. It's got to be a lot of games because the game's going to be the best teacher anyway. No, that's a valid point.
I look at this, I'm an analyst for my day job, so I always look at things as data points and not people, which is horrible to say, but...
Yeah, no, it's true.
If I can take the human element
out of the way of the world, man.
If I can take the human element out of it, I can be a non-bias on my own child.
I'm the same guy. I live your life.
What different pathways do you have with the national team finding players and take them to college showcases? But what other pathways do you have? Do you have connections with professional teams throughout the country then to try to help them find players like showcases do for colleges or recommendations? I know that a lot of MLS clubs have national team coaches on their staff, so I won't say why FC Dallas sends so many kids to the national team or why we have so many kids from the Metroplex here in DFW going to play on the youth national teams all over the world. Do you have close ties to programs?
A lot of ours has to. Yeah. And main tie, obviously, is with USYS. I'm trying to build the collegiate one as well. We do have some ties within the scout network within US Soccer. That's one of those. And then, obviously, one of the things we may try to look at is try to push in to hopefully find those players that go into the clubs and not just the FC Dallas club. But if there's a player that we can identify that could benefit through, say, like a Solar or BBB or Celtic, something like that, to where they can be identified for one of those clubs, obviously that's ideal. Since our main purpose is identification for different teams and different groups, we're obviously not the end. We're just a middle goal or the middleman of soccer.
And this is going to make me feel uncomfortable then, because this is an awkward question to ask. You have coaches, and most of your coaches, I understand, coach with clubs. And the biggest complaint I hear from coaches talking with them.
Oh, no.
And the question I get asked, I always ask them, why are you reluctant to send your players to ODP? And one of them is that they get recruited and sent to other clubs. So I get why you're going to asking an ODP this. So how do you keep coaches from ultimately poaching,
recruiting
indirectly or directly for their club?
Well, and that's one of the big factors that we talk about, especially within our meetings. Whenever we do have a coach that is coaching club, they're not allowed to coach within their age group or within the gender that they're coaching. So, for example, one of our coaches is a highly respected club coach, but he's not allowed to be in his age group. So he can't recruit for his teams because that's something that's obviously frowned upon. We try to keep away, even like parents. If you got one of our coaches is a parent, we don't allow them to coach within the team that their kid would play into. Because to your point, it would destroy us if we're actually out there recruiting for different clubs and they use us to pick people off. I will say this in the background, though, some of the parents, they're usually the ones that are watching players and talking to one another. And I think that may be where it's more coming from rather than our coaches themselves doing it. Because I know we've got a lot of high quality coaches within our program, but I'm hoping and I may be totally incorrect and I hope I am not. But I don't think they're out there to try to recruit. I think they're out there for the betterment of the players. And we do have quite a few high school coaches out there as well that have no ties to club.
And that's the thing. I look at it as this. I am very proud of where I work at. And doesn't matter where I go. If someone was looking for a job, if I know that they're capable of doing it, I'll be slipping them a job number.
No.
That's the thing that coaches say. It doesn't matter if they are not coaching their age or their gender. It is they're doing a push. Their club, because that's who they're loyal to at the end of the day. And yeah, there might be some of it in the background, but that's the big thing is that Coach A might go coach B in their club. Come look at this player. Check out this player that we have. They might fit in your squad quite well. And not to your knowledge, this is going on. I'm just saying this is where coaches that I have talked to from the west side to the east side, south and north side of the Metroplex all have had complaints is that, yes, this coach may not coach that age, but they will see a player and their loyalty is to their club on top of ODP. And
no, for sure.
How do you handle that type of stuff? Or do you just hope that your coaches are making the best decisions to represent ODP the best?
I'll tell you what, if you have anybody if they're listening to the podcast and you know for sure that happens, let me know quickly and I can deal with it. Like I said, we talk about that as well. But in this environment, and you know as well as I, probably maybe more so than I in this club environment, everybody's so scared of that one event that people are poaching off each other to where, geez, I think it's happening more often on the sidelines where there's coaches going around, walking the sidelines, finding players, finding parents, and recruiting out of it. That's not our goal. Our goal is just to develop players. If somebody came up and asked me what high school I taught at, I for sure would have said, you know, in a heartbeat, Colleyville Heritage, but that's not saying come play for us. And then there might be two that they may mesh with that coach or they may not. With that, I guess people are going to be people, and that's our best coaches we're going to grab that we possibly can for the program. And outside of that, we just got to believe in our people and believe in the character of our coaches. And I don't think they would honestly do it on purpose, but if they do, I'll sure deal with that as well.
With this going down this avenue with coaches, because I think coaches are a big part of our soccer community, how do you keep ODP's philosophies and the philosophy of ODP through the highest level coach down to the lowest age group coach and trying to keep what the message needs to be clean and clear to everyone else?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just the relationship we've built within our coaches. So we've got, I believe there's 20 to 25 coaches on staff. It makes it a lot easier for me to constantly talk to them, to be out there, to walk in the fields, to be at the practices and whatnot. So we see what they're doing, how they're doing it. And when we bring somebody in the coaching group, the first thing we're looking for is quality character, people that we know we can trust, people that are going to work hard, that are there for kids. And those are the people that I try to recruit back into the program. So whenever, for example, we got Ryan Evans at 2010, he worked for me at Colleyville Heritage, probably not find a better human being. We're going to bring him in. And I used him specifically because he had no club ties when I got him. So that's the example we're looking for. Somebody that I know that cares about kids is going to do the right things. Successful people with good character are way more powerful than just people that win games. I want people that are there to develop kids and care about kids.
And I think that's hard to find because I feel like there's three egos out there. There is player-centric ego, parent right. or coach, and then there's coach-centric ego and parent-centric ego. And to find a coach that's truly player-centric ego, like you said, all coaches have ego. It's where they play right. that ego dictates, in my opinion, how successful they will be. If it's coach-centric, it's all about their win, the greatest, the next greatest player, and cherry-picking players so they can win. Parents are no different. Parents will go put their player on a squad that their player may be out of caliber, but the coach will take them because it is a filling a roster spot, and parents know that their kid might not play, but it's about being on a winning team. And I'm going to use Juan Martinez's quote that he used with me. It is finding these parents are Gucci parents, like right. me, and showing it on social media. No, sure. And where if it's a parent that's truly player-centric and ego, they're going to be happy when their player is developing. And as a parent, you're proud of your kid when they achieve their goals. Not so much winning. My son has been on losing teams, and we're still proud of him because he's growing as a player and he's doing what he needs to be doing. He can't dictate the team always. Or a coach that is, look at the player that I have developed. He learned that from me. I am so proud of him that he's still doing it 5 years from now. Yeah. Or the player gives that coach the credit, or the parent gives the coach the credit. And that's where the ego comes from, is the development of the player. And to find those player-centric coaches that are player-centric egoed coaches is very hard to find. I know a lot of your coaches on your staff, because I've read through them all, because I was curious on who they all are. It's hard to find parents to support that. So how long is your evaluation of a coach, or is it just because of, based on experience dealing with them, as I call it, in the wild of coaching against them or watching them, do you put a coach through the ringers before you hire them? Because I know that talking to a lot of the coaches that I know you have, they're very talented, and they're, most of them, I would say, are probably more player-centric ego than anything else.
No, for sure. And I think it comes down to good people. The proof is always going to be in the pudding. So when you watch the people, you listen to what they say, what they're talking about. Are they, first of all, when they describe themselves, do they talk about their team or do they talk about them? And I think probably the best way that I can think of judging a coach is that the success, I call it the success evaluation, but what it is success based upon their kids when they talk about their team, or is their success based upon themselves? For example, when we look at a coach that says, I won this, I won that, I did this, I did that, to me is a non-factor. So they may be a great person. I may like them a lot as a human being, but at the same time, I don't want them in within our program. If they come in and say, you know what, man, the kids came together, this was great. You wouldn't believe how we developed, won the game together. Oh, crud, lost that game, I blew this, I made that mistake. Those are the kind of things you're looking at as a person, because that's the person that's going to be your player-centric ego. Just looking a way to develop this. It's really trying to grow a program. And for us, that's what we need as coaches, because that really leads our philosophy. Most of our records aren't going to be held. We're not going to have a little public area where they're going to put the 05 girls, for example, went 6-0 over the course of the season. That's not the measure of success. Measure of success is where did they go, how did they go, and who did they become as people? My biggest joy is thinking about my little Maze is in Louisiana playing soccer in college. And to me, following along with her history and what she's done means everything to me. And most of the coaches that we have within our program are those kind of people that are looking for what the future is for these kids rather than what is or what it does for their record.
With placing players, so you have a lot of, you go to a showcase every year. Do you guys right. have a lot of players, because of your involvement in their soccer journey, get placed to go into college or go sign that pro contract or amateur contract, wherever it may be? Or is it a collective as a whole because of the soccer journey that they're on?
I think it's a collective of everything. We're one piece of the puzzle, if we're completely honest. One of the things that looks good on a college application will be the ODP or ODP participation. At the end of the day, if we're completely honest across the board, maybe 0.5% of any soccer player in the DFW Metroplex is going to go on to be a pro. And so you can think of, say, Ricardo Pepe, for example. How many Ricardo Pepes are in the Dallas Metroplex right now? Then we break down to, say, how many people are in FC Dallas from North Texas. That's going to be smaller. And then you take the next one, Division I soccer players. How many Division I programs are there? And so I think that as the pyramid goes higher and higher, the opportunities get less and less. I think, once again, it comes down to doing our best to provide the opportunities for players to get them seen and recognized. But I think the overall product or any goal of any good coach or any good program is that are they better people as a result of their participation? If that makes sense.
It's how do you structure your philosophy? So does it come from U.S. National Soccer Federation, or does it come internally from North Texas Soccer, or do you work with all the other ODPs throughout the regions throughout the United States to create a philosophy, a culture that you're going to build and cultivate then?
Well, a lot of it has been, and this is coming from 1 year, so I'm going to throw this out there as a caveat. So in this year that I've experienced, it comes from all different factors. Obviously, the federation has an input on what happens. Then we look at, like, Aaron Hefferman's been unbelievably good, and he's the director of ODP for USYS, has been insightful and helpful in giving advice and thoughts and philosophies. We've got great technical leaders around in my the people that I work with to do my job, say, for like Kincaid Hunt in South Texas, has been an unbelievable resource. We got Adam Keynes at Oklahoma, Costas. I can't even pronounce his last name, but I'm going to try. So, Costas, if you're listening, I'm going to butcher your name. Lahasa Gwalis out of Georgia that we can lean on. John Trice out of North Carolina. But there's people that we lean on pretty heavily on trying to figure out the path and the way. And so that's probably going to be a developing question answer that's going to take me a little while to get. But I will tell you, there's really good people that have helped drive the way we do things and the way we are learning and growing, because we're not the only way. I think we're doing pretty good, but there's a whole lot better ways of doing it. And that's our jobs to find and always try to improve and get better. And obviously there's North Texas philosophy through our board, which has done an incredible job of supporting our program. And so with that, and Dave Osborne being our director of ODP, as well as Janet, the president, I think there's things that they do to help drive the philosophy and what we look at and try to make us better.
Do you create a lesson plan for the season, for the year, and a playbook that you're doing a work on for your 8 sessions, or do you play it by the hip depending on where they're at? Do you look at their game films of these players that are part of your teams, trying to build a program around them to help them be the best that they can when they go compete? Or is it kind of the Wild West where you just shoot from the hip and figuring it out on the fly as a collective?
The beauty of it is this is a 1 year. What I'm giving you is 1 year of experience.
Right.
And so hopefully that helps out. But this last year, before we practiced, every coach is required to turn in a lesson plan. I never appreciate if somebody's telling me what to do and how to do it, because we're bringing in top people. And for example, if we take John and tell her, okay, here's what you're going to do and how you're going to do it, I think you take away some of the creative freedom, because I personally don't believe I have the answers. And she's going to have a better idea of you, what her team needs and how they need it. Now, we're going to follow a general idea. And for example, I think this year we're going to spend a little time on defending, because I think that's something that's negated in some of their outside programs. Now, obviously not all, but there's a good portion of programs that don't cover defending well, and it shows when we play. And so now it's within that structure or organizational. And now I guess the military term is commander's intent. We'll have an idea of what we want. But then I have to rely on my people and my coaches to be able to come up with a game plan that is suitable for the needs of their players, because they're working with them every day. That fits the model, that helps develop in the most appropriate manner, that's going to meet the needs of their kids. And I trust my coaches to be able to do that, because like I said, they are top people and they're very good at what they do.
That's awesome. I think that's hard. As a parent, how do I describe it? I always ask a coach, what is your game plan for the year? I know it changes based on the talent they're able to recruit and have in front of them. But I know that a lot of coaches, like, you have to build this foundation before you go to X, Y, and Z. Every coach, right. Every team that these coaches build, the foundation level may be at a different level. Some might be higher this year than they were last year, and some may be lower from the year before. And I know it's up to the coaches, but when I start talking to academies outside the United States, and I'm viewing more of a soccer academy or a club than I am ODP, right. Because that's how I view you coming into this conversation. When you talk to an EPL, English Premier League Academy, you work on these tactics at this age group to make sure this foundation is built before, let's say U10 or U12, these tactics, this foundation has to be here before they go to U13. And if they are not there, we have to build them all up. If 75% of your players are there, great. But you're only as strong as your weakest link in the chain. And do you have that type of mentality set up and built already? Just because as a parent that looks at this as the long-term gain and not just today. I have this conversation with a lot of parents and they tell me I'm wrong. And I'm fine with being wrong. I won't change my opinion because if the foundations aren't there, whatever you build on, it's going to crumble. We just look at the U.S. men's national team. There are things that are missing in our U.S. men's national team that were not built in the program when they were in their youth. And that's a shame on the United States for not encouraging the coaching programs or resources to be there to build a true foundation. So do you have like a cornerstone that you guys build off and go from there? Or do you, like you said, let your coaches, this is the things we want to see done and be accomplished, figure out how to get there? Or is it just trying to figure out what you have and trying to build as a collective?
I think there's two different things we're looking at. And to be honest with you, I agree with you. Because when I had players every day, for example, in the high school realm, there were certain things we had to do. So there's certain benchmarks I was looking at for my players to be at a certain place by the time season started. And so we spent a lot of time on the periodization of the program. If you have a club team, I will bet if you look like FC Dallas, for example, just because good friends with Chris Clark, who is an unbelievable guy, I'm pretty sure that he's got a program built in from their expectations from the beginning, especially with the organized and as anal as that guy is. But I'll bet there's a program through from start to finish, but they've got those kids every single day. Ours is a little bit different. Now you take that national team model where at ours, we've got four practices. When we take the fall, we've got 2 hour sessions. So basically if it's two times, so 8 hours total, we're not going to have the time to go in and build a foundational sense. Now we're going to have a foundational structure, so a tactical, say, idea. So if we're defending, for example, in a 4-3-3 is our preferred formation that we have, just because it mimics most of the formations around that the kids are participating in. There's going to be certain things, defensive principles they got to hit. There's certain attacking principles they're going to have to hit, and that's what we're going to focus on. And a lot of this stuff is taken from, and anybody can look it up, is the key qualities that U.S. soccer set forward. So I know it hadn't come up, but how we judge the players is based on that. How we do evaluations is based on the key qualities and the professional or the positional profiles. But our coaches have those things. And so our idea is now to be able to take kids from various backgrounds, much like your national team example, where you have a kid playing at Byron and a kid playing at Juventus. Now you're trying to take those two things where they're playing every day, and now you're trying to meld them into one program or one idea when they're seeing something different all the time to be able to play them together as a unit, if that makes sense. So ours is going to be a little bit different than our overall periodization model where an FC Dallas would be.
Now, with your coaching staff, this all goes back to that. So when you're, as you're building your coaching staff, your philosophy as an organization dictate, how do you distinguish the characteristics a player must have to be part of ODP? There's on the pitch and off the pitch characteristics, which let's break down the player now, so to speak, as the best that we can.
Perfect. I'll tell you what I'll do is at the end of this, when we get off the call, I don't know if you have attachments that you attach within the podcast where people can go for like further information, but and you can look it up on US soccer. Just if you Google US soccer's key qualities and positional profiles, it'll list it out. And it's very in-depth. It's only 2 pages, so it's not going to take somebody to 20 minutes to read, but it breaks down the key qualities based on 6 different values. And then it breaks each position and what's looked for and how it's supposed to do. And obviously, if we're part of the Federation, we're going to follow those models. We do have, I'm working on right now to set up an identification process that we're bringing somebody that's a scout from US soccer that's going to help go walk through our coaching staff. A way to evaluate the players to use in the positional profiles and the key qualities. And like I said, it's in the works right now to set up. And we've got it set. I just have to lock down a date, but it's a lady I've been blessed to be able to work with. And so she's incredibly knowledgeable and a great person and said she'd help us out with it. So we're trying to align ourselves with the Federation as much as possible. When our coaches go out on the 28th of July, August 4th and August 11th, they're following what U.S. soccer's recommendations are. And based upon those same key qualities and positional profiles.
With the player profiles that you're gathering, do you share this with at a national level to let's say you have a U15 player. Do you share these profiles with the national teams, trying to help them find players to scout? Because I know they have their own scouts and everything along those lines. But do you have more of an influence because you're supposed to be part of the pathway program? Or, as parents have pointed out, you have no teeth or no arm in the fight, so to speak, anymore, because MLS next, and before that it was the DA and the club, right, PC, right. And now these scouts go watch them. But once again, in my opinion, those are just the kids that have the resources to go play at those higher levels, and that's not always the case, as we talked about earlier.
I know for sure on the women's side that we can pick up a phone anytime, and I'm sure on the men's side it wouldn't be a problem to do the same thing. Because if you're with U.S. soccer, and just speaking on the women's side, because that's where I had most experience, is that those people are generally interested in finding the best players. They don't care where they play, what they do. They want to find the best players from the national team. And I'm pretty sure, and like I said, not to speak out of turn, but I have more connections within the women's side. But on the men's side, it's just going to be the same thing. If you've got a rock star, they don't care where the rock star comes from. They just want it to be there. And so by identifying those talents, if we find those talents or those kids, we're 100% going to make the call. And I promise you that they're going to want to find that kid and look at that kid. Because at the end of the day, the only way we're all successful is we find the best players possible. And that's where our bread and butter is.
I really appreciate that honest opinion there. Now, with everything going through the process of the player profiles, where do you do these tryouts? Where do you have your tryouts? Let's start there.
The tryouts will be on January 28th. It'll be at Fairview Park in McKinney, Texas. We've got that locked in. And like I said, all the stuff's on the website. And then August 4th and August 11th, we're using four different schools in the Eagle Mountain Saginaw School District there in North Fort Worth on the west side. And so it'll be Boswell, Eagle Mountain, Chisholm Trail, and Saginaw High School. So those four different high schools have two turf fields that we can use for the trials. So we'll split up our groups for that to make sure that we've got enough field space and enough high quality pitches that we can actually do a decent job of identifying players. You know, Fairview is awesome, but it's grass. But so weather may become an issue, but pretty sure that we're good on turf, that we can keep it going unless there's lightning.
I don't think people realize how big the Metroplex is, because when I look at the Metroplex, it has grown to be bigger than the state of Connecticut. And when you actually...
Oh, man. Yeah, my drive feels like it's bigger than the state of Connecticut to work every day.
But... If you put the city, the state of Connecticut in the Metroplex, we're well beyond the boundaries of the state borders now. Right. And I don't think people realize how... That's where tryouts are. Now, are there training sessions on both sides of the Metroplex? Or are you mostly in the West because you have access to those great facilities?
We're trying. And that's one thing that I know in the past was an issue, because I think it's a fair complaint that parents will have, is if I'm in the Plano, for example, to be able to drive to Fort Worth, maybe a burden. But we're doing everything we can to find those fields. The fields are like the ultimate supply or ultimate thing you have to have. Getting a field at any point in time is incredibly difficult and sometimes can be incredibly expensive depending on what's going on. And then you take the fact that anybody that cares about their field is going to rest and rotate their fields out so it doesn't get overused, because it'll destroy a field, adds to the problem. So whenever we get, say, like an Eagle Mountain Saginaw School District that's willing to help us out, that's just gold. So that helps out. But we're trying, and that's the only thing that we're working on and we're looking at. But I said, I remember back when I was in Midland and we're bringing my son here to ODP, and that was a 5.5-hour trek. That was not fun either. But that's what we used to do. Yeah. You know, I sympathize with those parents. I know what they're thinking because I've lived it.
Now, is ODP for the Metroplex, is it only on weekends for those training sessions? Is it during the week?
Sunday afternoon or evening, or Sunday during the day? The reason being is that we try to do our best to make sure we don't have practices on club games, which is incredibly rough. Or we try to skirt around different tournament seasons. It's difficult. Our goal is not to take away from the club program, only to enhance participation for those athletes. Like I told you before, if they've got a conflict between a game and ODP practice, our expectation is that they go to their game with their clubs. We're a supplemental program. That scheduling is pretty difficult. And we try to keep it Sunday to mitigate the different activities that might conflict with what we're doing.
You commented it saying it's a supplement to program. So how often do you have players that aren't able to make your training sessions? I know that's might be rare that they might not be able to make all of them, or it might be more common that they can make majority of them. If you have eight, they might make seven or six of them. But how often do the players actually get picked for ODP and never make a session? Because, like I said, to me, chemistry is so important. And if they can't commit,
sure.
Is there a commitment value the family has to make to ODP to make a certain amount of sessions? Or is it, like you said, it's a supplement to
the club? Now, our goal, obviously, we expect 50%, at least 50% of the participation in the program thing. Obviously, there's going to be times when that's not possible, but our request is that the parents can reach out to us, let us know what's going on, so we can have an understanding of what's happening. But it seems to me you wouldn't pay $600 and not be a part of anything. And it happens. And there's some that come to the end, and had a couple this year that asked why they didn't get selected for a region camp, for example. And you go, we haven't seen you. How could we? You may play for XYZ club, but at the end of the day, if we never seen you play, how do we recommend you then for the next level of participation?
I'm going to wrap this up with my two favorite questions for you and my favorite question. And I'm assuming you played at some point in time in your life because of how much you love soccer and you've coached. And the other half of this question is as a coach. So who has been your greatest influence as a coach? I mean, as a player, so let me start off with a player. So it could be a parent, a friend, an actual player that you idolized, and the same exact question as a coach. So who has been your favorite influence as a coach?
Okay, how long you got? No, it's okay, because there's been unbelievable amounts of influences on me as a person, because every time even this conversation is going to influence what I do. But there's one in particular. I remember when I was a little guy, went out to, grew up in El Paso to like the eighth grade in El Paso, Texas. And we go out to this little field. Mom takes me out to this field. And we're standing around, and all these other little kids, and my mom's the only one out there and standing around still, and they all look at her, and then she became our soccer coach because there's really nobody else there. And so mom's influence on me has been unreal, because she's the one that got me started within the game. She became the coach. So I always look back on what I'm doing related to her. I look at, actually, I'm going to give you three. The next one would be Randy Swick out of San Angelo, Texas, because he was my club coach when I was growing up. But when I started at Angelo State, and going to school there, I got the weird itch to coach soccer, and I still don't understand. I think God just opened the door and said, hey, dude, go pick up the phone and call San Angelo Soccer Association. And I walked over, called it, and in those days, you didn't have to background check or anything, which is scary now that they let some college guy take a team. But he took me under his wing and really took me through the place, got me in the coaching club. And then the third one will be a Dennis Cavalier, which is the one I owe everything to the way I coach what I do. But as a first high school coach coming out of Angelo State University, going to Pampa, Texas, and the only way I knew where Pampa was up in the panhandles because I did the old school when you have the map and you went C3 and you figured out by marking the two, that's where the city is. But this was an old football coach guy. And in that 1 year, I learned more about coaching and teaching from that one man than I had in all the years leading up, whether it be college or whatnot. But he took me under his wing. He actually put me on the football staff for eighth grade, and he did it more. I didn't realize it then. Did it more to help develop me as a coach and a person than it was for me to help him out with football, because I knew nothing about football. And so to really honor him, it was that little bit of kindness that you take for somebody else and take me under his wing and saw value that developed me into the coach that I became and I feel like I am now, really, to those three people.
Hey everyone, I hope you all have enjoyed this week's episode of Chat by the Pitch. Warren was a great guest. What he talked about kind of opened my eyes a little bit more. I'm not going to be so tough on ODP. I think what they're trying to do is a good thing overall. I think there's ways to improve it, and he's open to ideas how to work on it here in North Texas. I think there can be a lot of opportunities here for players to work with ODP, to play with ODP. And I think in time when there's someone at the top that wants it to be better, and if he has the tools and is able to by the organization, it will get better. What I know of him, and talking to a few people around, I'm sorry, Warren, but I did ask about you to a few people. They had nothing but great things to say about him, that he truly wants this program to be successful. And I think he has a great chance as long as he has the support to do it. Hey, everyone. If you guys have enjoyed this podcast, have enjoyed what I've been trying to do, the messages that I'm putting out there, please give me some ratings, some stars on all the podcast sites that you listen to this on. Give me a review, share this, share with others. The more I can make this grow, the more I can continue doing this. I'm really trying to make a difference in our soccer community. So I hope you guys have enjoyed all this. And until next time, I'll see you at the pitch.